The Athletic. Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast from The Athletic.
Coming up on this week's show.
Depleted mags keep ravenous wolves at bay to remain unbeaten.
Sunday at Kingston Park with George, Becky Langley sets out her stall for success with Newcastle's women.
And the wisdom of signing Isak. Shearer approves, but do we need more reinforcements after a bruising spell? Yes, hello once again. This is Pod on the Tyne, but neither of us is Taylor Payne, who was fighting the Lurgy. Get well soon, Taylor. But we are here nonetheless to bring you the latest on a very exciting few days at Newcastle United. My name is George Culkin. Joining me is Christopher Waffle Waffles, who was at Wolverhampton Wanderers on Sunday. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm feeling a bit all over the place, and I don't know if that's because I was in Wolves over the weekend, if because Taylor isn't here and we're having to pretend that we know how to host a podcast. I just don't know what's going on, really. It's been a very busy few days, but in many ways a very positive few days for Newcastle United. So how are you doing anyway, George?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yes, I mean, without Taylor, we're sort of left to run amok on this podcast, so please bear with us. And yeah, Wolves, I mean, that was pretty much that was at the very limits of your acceptable range of travelling for a Newcastle United away match, wasn't it?
Well, you see, it was almost beyond the boundaries. You see, I did feel as we were going there, it's beyond Birmingham, you have to go the other side. So when I was going, I was thinking, you know, George should really be doing this, so actually I think I've let you off for the week, so you should be grateful.
One little quirky little thing, though. You went down the night before and you actually ended up staying in the team hotel, didn't you?
We did, yes, which we didn't know about until I went down with John Anderson and Matthew Raisbeck from BBC Newcastle. And until we pulled into the car park for the hotel and there was just two massive team buses, it hadn't dawned on us that it was the team's hotel. I'm not sure people around the club necessarily realised that. I think they thought, it's quite often we stay here. They must have realised in advance. We didn't. I would be a far better journalist if I had realised in advance, but I hadn't. So we were in the same hotel as the team and spoke to a few members of staff in and around, and it was good to see them. And obviously, their preparations must have been decent because they ended up getting a positive point, which we'll go into in a second. So
yeah, and so presumably as a award winning journalist, you got a lot of exclusive stories out of that, which you'd like to share with us now, right, Chris?
Where those awards are and when I was awarded them, I would like to know first. Okay. To be confirmed. Yeah.
Fine.
They're to be confirmed, put it that way.
Okay, fair enough. So, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the backdrop to Wolves. I was at Tranmere on the Wednesday and I loved it. It was, great going. I sort of love doing those games against lower league teams when there's a win at the end of it, and there was a win at the end of it, but it was a bruising match as well, and I think Newcastle were feeling the effects of that going into the Wolves game, weren't they?
They were, yeah. I mean, obviously, certain players, Jamal Lascelles with his bloodied nose, he was in the squad, but there'd been other players who ended up missing out. I mean, just before we get on those individual players, how was your Wednesday in Tranmere, George? I mean, you are, in theory, our cup correspondent now anyway, and how was the start of your cup odyssey, as you're terming it?
Yeah, well, I wanted to sort of do something a bit different. It's not sort of about putting pressure on the team or the club or anything like that, but it is that feeling of renewal when it comes to cups. We know that under Steve Bruce, the team got to a couple of quarterfinals, but those cup runs sort of ended pretty depressingly. And there was always that sense that eventually Newcastle would hit the ceiling in terms of how far they would progress. You know, I don't think people wanted it to be Brentford, for example, in the second one. But, it was nice while those runs lasted, but it did feel that the club wasn't geared up to win something, to be successful. That is now changing. It's a stated ambition of everyone, including Eddie Howe, who has spoken quite strongly for him, I think, on the importance of competitions. Whether Newcastle are ready now, that's certainly up to debate because, as we all know, it tends to be the big teams who win the big trophies. But it's just lovely having that sense of a club trying again. And for me, that's why I wanted to, you know, to sort of term it this Cup Odyssey. That was game one of the Cup Odyssey. Cambridge United last season doesn't count as far as I'm concerned because there was only one priority back then, and that was still the very much the old regime team, I would put it. It was very much an old regime result. So yeah, I loved it. I went there. Tough opening, tough match, but great surroundings, a great club, and then that sort of challenge of being kicked off the park. I will also point out that they got mine before you do. I can see that smirk on your face, which obviously our listeners can't. The Tranmere press office did get my name wrong on my seat. So
Culkin,
yeah, the incredible Culkin. But you know, they tried to kick Newcastle off the park, but they got through it. And I think one of the sort of best things for me was, although I saw on Twitter some people being sort of upset that players like Bruno came on, and perhaps rightly, bearing in mind he missed Wolves, but Newcastle brought on 140 million quid's worth of player to win that game, and they did win it. And yeah, I'm very pleased with that. Palace next up, looking forward to part two. And, you know, there was also a very good run out of Elliot Anderson, who I thought was excellent.
He was, and it's interesting that you mentioned part two is going to be Crystal Palace, because at one stage it looked like part two was going to be the FA Cup in January, which is quite often the case for Newcastle. Yep. And this may be like waiting for Godot in many ways, mightn't it, in terms of Newcastle's long recent last 60-odd years of failure to win domestic trophies. They are a very different club now, but previously, before Mike Ashley, there was the ambition to win things, and it just didn't quite happen. But yeah, I think it's an interesting thought for a series, and it may continue for a long period of time, but let's hope that it is. Hopefully it doesn't. Let's hope we can end it quite soon.
It's going to take me to retirement, Chris, that's for certain, and possibly you as well, but we'll see. But yeah, no, a bit of fun and a nice way of doing it. Right, come on, let's get on to Wolves. So yeah, obviously Newcastle were without, I mean, you can argue that they were out with a lot of the spine of the team, so no Bruno, no Wilson, and obviously no Emil Kraft as well. So,
no Shelvey.
And no Shelvey too. So, I mean, overall, you have to be satisfied with a point away from home, don't you? And you have to be satisfied in those circumstances.
Yeah, I think so. It was a very odd match. For the first 20 minutes, 25 minutes, I thought Newcastle were pretty good until the final third. Joe Willock should have scored, Mr. Sitter. But apart from that, Newcastle sort of were the better team, but without really making it count. Then Wolves took control for a while when Newcastle dominated possession, took the lead, and Newcastle, for large parts of second half, sort of flattered to deceive. A lot of good work, but then again, final decision-making wasn't there. And then Alan Saint-Maximin scores a ridiculous goal, which we'll get onto, and Newcastle probably should have won it in the end. So it was odd, but if you'd offered a lot of Newcastle fans a draw at Wolves before the game, I think many would have taken it. And the way I sort of termed it in my piece reflecting on the game was that if you put into context where Newcastle were the last time they were Molyneux, obviously you were there, that terrible away end. The final match of the Ashley era, but nobody knew it at the time that was the final act. And everyone felt so despondent that nothing was going to get better, that it was just going to be the same over and over again. Newcastle have come a heck of a long way since then. The resilience they showed, the quality they showed in many ways, the ability to take the game to Wolves rather than sit off them, that 60-odd percent possession at Molyneux. You see where the progress is, but also you also see the direction of travel they're going into, that it's going to take time for them to get exactly where they want to be. And missing the key players that you mentioned, they don't yet really have the depth to fully compensate for them. I thought the players who came in different parts did well, but without Wilson leading the line, you lack a real potent goal threat. And Isak, unfortunately, was not available to make his debut despite being there because his work permit was not through in time, so he could not feature. Chris Wood just didn't really get any service, only had three touches in the box and didn't impose himself on the game enough. Then you had Sean Longstaff filling in that deep-lying role because there's no Shelvey, there's no Bruno Guimaraes because he was injured. Eddie Howe was a bit strange in terms of how he spoke about Bruno because he was asked in several different interviews and all he said was a slight knock. He didn't go beyond exactly what that was. And I think the interesting thing about Bruno's injury was it was a very... It was uncovered in a very 2022 sort of way. First of all, fans had deduced that he wasn't in training pictures late in the week, and then he didn't send out his usual pre-match tweet on the morning of the game, and therefore fans had worked out before it had actually been confirmed that Bruno wasn't going to feature. And I think that Newcastle did lack a little something there, but the fact that they managed to come through without those top players and get a draw was a very creditable point in the end.
And you talk about that resilience. I mean, in the space of a week, Newcastle have gone a goal behind three times and they've come back to get a positive result. I mean, I think, you know, three very, very different games against Manchester City, Tranmere in the Cup, and then at Wolves. But, I mean, that resilience is hugely important and very creditable to them. Is that, I mean, do we think that sort of mentality is now rubbing off on Alan Saint-Maximin? Because it was a wonderful goal, yes, but it comes on top of that performance against Manchester City as well. Is resilience part of his makeup now, do we think?
Just before I get on that, just in terms of to describe the goal, I mean, I'm sure you've all seen it, but it goes from the ridiculous to the sublime, because Jacob Murphy's down the right wing and turns into a couple of Wolves players on the right-hand edge of the box on the byline. And then Huang, the Wolves player, tries to clear the ball and just ends up launching it massively into the air, and it dips on the edge of the D. And Saint-Maximin just runs onto it and somehow, despite the ball dropping almost vertically, manages to position his body so that he catches it. It does probably come off his shin. I think it was termed as shinned on Match of the Day. It's the best shinner I've ever seen, if it was. But it probably did come off the sort of shin to then just fly into the bottom right-hand corner of the net. I mean, Josie Sarr barely even moves because it's there that quickly. It was a absolutely outrageous strike, and afterwards Eddie Howe said that when it was coming down, when the ball was dropping, he didn't have a clue what Saint-Maximin was going to do. He's that unpredictable. He says he knows that Alan is capable of so many things, but doesn't know what he's going to do in that situation. And in terms of Saint-Maximin himself, we're starting to hopefully see that. We're still at the beginning of that process, because he started last season very well. He was probably the one player who really actually dragged Newcastle to the point that they had in the last vestiges of the Steve Bruce era. I think he's on a higher level now than he was then, but he needs to consistently prolong and show this. Eddie Howe was very keen after the game to pinpoint Saint-Maximin's work rate and the fact that he was the one of the players who'd run back when Wolves had their second goal disallowed for VAR, correctly by VAR, because Fraser had been fouled. But Saint-Maximin had run the length of the pitch and then was up at the other end of the pitch ready to score the equaliser and almost score a winner later on as well. So we did see a lot more from him, although in the first half he was frustrating. He was back to being the getting a lot of the ball, hanging on for it for too long, shooting at opposition players. But I think that there has been a bit of a mentality switch, certainly in the recent short term, and it's about making sure that they extend that further. That's what Howe and his coaching staff are looking to try and do. And I think I think the fact that he went and embraced Jason Tindall after Dan Byrne had come and basically bear hugged him off the
pitch,
I think
man. That
should, exactly.
Brave man.
I think that showed a lot about the sort of feeling there is between them all and it rubbing off at the moment. And hopefully they keep Alan Saint-Maximin in this sort of mood for longer, because he can be devastating, what we've seen in the last two Premier League matches.
You mentioned the Ryan Fraser incident that saw a second goal for Wolves ruled out. There were two or three very sort of contentious issues, or sort of looked at it at the time. So let's rattle through those very quickly. The shirt pull on Sean Longstaff when a penalty wasn't given, that looked like the wrong decision to me. What do you think?
I thought it was the wrong decision as well. I mean, I had a debate in the car on the way back with John Anderson, the former Newcastle defender, who basically was of the opinion...
Took the defender side.
Yeah. In his day, you know, that wouldn't have been a foul. He wasn't completely arguing against the whole thing. He was just saying it was a bit soft. And in some ways, it would have been a bit soft. But equally, he makes no attempt to get the ball and just drags Sean Longstaff's back by his shirt. And if that had been in the middle of the pitch, that cliche of it would have been a free kick, and it certainly would have been. So that one, I thought Newcastle were very unfortunate. I think they were a little bit fortunate with Fabian Schärs on Pedro Neto. He'd tried to clear the ball and had just ended up belting it into the back of Joe Willock. And I think he was frustrated for his own failure to clear it. And he sort of rushes in. Neto gets there ahead of him. And he is late. His foot does sort of catch the very bottom of almost the shin going at the ankle of Pedro Neto. I think the height of it probably just stopped him from getting upgraded to red. If it had been slightly higher, I think it would have been a red card. But I think he was a little bit lucky, because it was reckless.
It looked a bit orange to me, that card, I suppose. It'd be one of those ones. And that was described as really, really dangerous by Ruben Neves. But Ruben Neves said a few strange things after the match yesterday. And he talked about Newcastle's style of play, long balls and second balls. They're not a team who wants to have the possession too much. We knew that, and we prepared really well for that. What possession did Newcastle have in that game yesterday, Chris?
Newcastle had 64% possession in their long ball, second ball style of play, not wanting the ball.
So what's he going on about?
I don't really know, because actually that was how I thought Wolves played. Wolves were strange in that it was very much... And Neves was brilliant. One of the passes Neves played in the first half is one of the best passes I think I've ever seen live. He's almost falling over, and he just pings this pass with his right foot out to the right wing to set Wolves away. And that was the way that Wolves played. They were very deep and then were trying to sort of counter-attack in a very much old-style Newcastle sort of way. And in the second half, I thought Wolves ran out of puff almost. They couldn't, defensively, they couldn't get high enough up the pitch because they looked shattered. And it was Newcastle who were taking it to them and looking to sort of overload and dominate. So I don't really know where he got that from. I think it was just heightened frustration. Maybe it was just old cliches of what they thought previously. When you play against Newcastle, that's what they bring. But that's not the Newcastle United, certainly not of this season. You could argue longer term over Eddie Howe, but certainly not the way they've come back and started this campaign. They've had more possession than the opposition, I think, in three of their four Premier League games. The only one they haven't, I believe, was Manchester City. They are looking to have the ball. They are looking to try and attack at every opportunity. They've got a higher line. In some ways, you could maybe argue for large spells against Wolves, they probably should have gone longer, because Chris Wood, that if you're going to have Chris Wood in the team, that would have suited him more. And actually, I think Chris Wood may have been frustrated once he went off the pitch and sitting looking from the bench, because Ryan Fraser comes on, and at that point, Miguel Almiron whips a ball in from the left with his left foot. Ryan Fraser comes on, puts a few balls across the box like that, targets on the pitch, and suddenly whipping corners in like that. Chris Wood didn't get across like that when he was on the pitch. And so it was almost backwards the way that Newcastle played in some ways, and they needed Wood on the pitch for that. And it probably would have suited them more to do what Ruben Neves said. So I don't really know. I mean, he seemed to be very, very animated in that post-match interview, and I don't really know where any of his comments, where that came from. It's just bizarre.
And Chris, I mean, we've barely mentioned this, but Alexander Isak was, of course, at Molineux as well, watching his new team, not playing because his work permit didn't come through. But Newcastle have made a huge signing. They've smashed their transfer record. Do you think that'll be useful for him to have watched the team, first off? And secondly, just talk a bit more generally about what Newcastle have done here and the idea with Isak moving forward.
I mean, in terms of the game itself, Howe made this point afterwards. He was asked about Isak, and Howe said that he'll have seen the pace and frenetic nature of the Premier League, because certainly in the second half, the game was just so end-to-end, it was so open, and it probably isn't like much he's experienced in the Spanish League over the last few years. And that basically he almost challenged Isak as well. He said he's going to bring his heck of a lot, but also he needs to realise he needs to put in these physical levels and match the physical output that we've shown in these matches. As for the deal itself, it's a massive deal, and I mean, I've written about it on The Athletic. There are quite a few pieces that you can read about Isak there. Alan Shearer has done a bit looking through this sort of style of play and his goals. I've done a piece with Mark Carey looking at the sort of player he is, and then also a piece looking at how the deal really came about. And the way the deal did come about was between basically our last podcast and this podcast, Newcastle completely changed tack and what they were trying to do in an attacking sense. Isak was the top target all summer in many ways. He was the unanimous decision across the transfer committee as to the striker that they would ideally have liked. But as recently as July, senior sources were saying when we're out in Austria that he was just too expensive. Newcastle had sort of gone with it and proposed, hadn't made an official bid, but sort of proposed that maybe they could be going up, willing to go up to something like 50 million. And Sociedad has sort of said he's not for sale, we're not going to do that. You'd have to meet his release clause, which is about £76 million. And Newcastle weren't prepared to do that. They were in discussions to sign João Pedro from Watford over the course of the weekend of the Man City game. They made a final proposal of about 20 million plus 5 million. In add-ons, 25 million plus 5 million add-ons, and basically it was almost like that's our final offer, Watford, you take it or leave it sort of thing, and they just sort of left it. At the same time, they then, after Callum Wilson's injury against Manchester City, forced a bit of a rethink, as Eddie Howe admitted on Fridays, to the sort of striker they were looking for, and they realised they needed probably someone who could play through the middle as well as out wide. and also Yasser El-Romain was there, so a wonderful game, and at least some people suggest that maybe that had an impact, as it did in January, whenever the chairman was there, seemed to be greater funds were released. Certainly, Newcastle went back to Sociedad, and over the course of a few days, Ashworth flew out, and to cut a long story short, Newcastle eventually went and made a club record offer and brought Isak to Tyneside. So basically, the deal was done in the space of 3 or 4 days, a club record deal, which they managed to conclude in the space of between two Premier League matches. And it does feel huge, because Newcastle have needed defensive reinforcements. It's been the priority all summer, and yet they hadn't signed anyone. The only striker that signed post-takeover was Chris Wood up till this point. So this feels like a massive deal for Newcastle United.
We've talked a lot about the sort of evolution of Newcastle, whether it's off the pitch or on it. But, you know, we've looked at the team, how it's been strengthened in a way that keeps the ethos of the, you know, the team that was there before intact, and how that's very important. But if you take a step back now and you look at the spine of the team, theoretically, you've got Botman at centre-half, you've got Bruno in midfield, you've got Isak playing in a forward position. Suddenly, that starts to look like a very different Newcastle, doesn't it? And, you know, very exciting. They're not there yet, clearly, in terms of personnel, in terms of squad quality, but that starts to look like a very exciting and different Newcastle, doesn't it?
It does, and the three players you mentioned also sort of symbolise the model of the player that Newcastle are looking for and have been looking for, which is to sign players who they think can become among the very best in Europe, but who aren't quite there yet. They are signing potential to a certain extent, but they don't want to pay the high wages and inflated fees yet for players who are already at that level. They want to sign them before they're there, even if it is for quite a lot of money, because they think they'll develop into better players. There is it's interesting, because there's an irony that Mike Ashley model to an extent mirrored this, but Newcastle are going for a higher quality of player now, and also they have a club geared to actually help those players reach their potential and to make sure that they grow with the club. It isn't to come to Newcastle necessarily to go elsewhere. The hope is that this is going to be the spine of the team in theory for years to come, or they can replenish it with other players and build it. And so I do think you are starting to really see, as you say, that spine of the team looks different. And I'm fascinated to see how Isak fits in, because Howe's said that he sees him and Wilson playing together, as well as Isak being able to play through the middle instead of him. He played basically all of his football last year for Sociedad was through the middle, but previously has played out on the right or left. And a front three of Alan Saint-Maximin, Alexander Isak and Callum Wilson, I think, is really quite exciting, actually.
All right, it is time for a quick break, but we do need to tell you about this offer for podcast listeners. You can subscribe to The Athletic at a special price of just £1 a month for the first 6 months. To claim that offer, go to theathletic.com/Newcastle Pod and get access to all our great writing, as well as ad-free versions of The Athletic's podcasts. That's theathletic.com/Newcastle Pod. Please sign up now.
Come on, you Maggies.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, and we finally reached the closing week of the summer transfer window. Premier League clubs have spent more than their German, Italian, Spanish and French counterparts combined, and they are not done yet. Don't miss any of the twists and turns with myself, David Ornstein, Adam Crafton and many more on the Athletic Football Podcast this week, as we take you inside the deals that really matter. We're free to listen wherever you get your podcasts, and we're ad-free on the Athletic app.
Right, and let's move on to George's alternative Sunday, because while I was actually going to an away game for once and not sending George, he was
very kind of you, Chris. Very kind of you.
You're welcome. He remained in the northeast, and he was at Kingston Park, and adding detail really to a story which broke last week, which we've trailed for quite a while and has been in the pipeline basically since the takeover, and that is that the women's team have now been officially brought into the club structure. Previously, for the last few years, they've been run through the club's foundation, But Amanda Staveley, one of her big, big goals since coming into the club was to make the women's team be competitive, to professionalise them and to move them up into the upper echelons of the women's game, really. And Becky Langley, the manager, has become full-time now. She previously wasn't. And George, you spoke to her last week for an interview before going this match, didn't you?
Yes, I did, and I wanted to do some of that for the podcast. I'm also going to write that interview, so by the time the pod's out, that should be up. And I just wanted to, kind of get a feel for what's happening with the women's team, try and get across all those different changes. But I also wanted to go to the match too and see, you know, get a feeling for that too. But anyway, yes, I did speak to Becky Langley at St James's last week, and I asked her to explain the exact nature of the changes that are taking place at the club.
Yeah, we're absolutely delighted that Newcastle United Women has moved kind of from being looked after by Newcastle United Foundation, and we've moved into the real main body of the club. Amanda Staveley's support and the board's support with regards to us moving to be part of that Newcastle family has been really, really important. And it means that myself, I can go full-time as the first full-time women's manager. And it means that the players are going to be much more supported on and off the pitch. So yeah, we're absolutely delighted with that. And it just makes us feel more a part of the family and more a part of the furniture at Newcastle United.
I mean, symbolically, it feels very, very important. Is that how it feels to you too?
Yeah, I feel like I've made history already in terms of going full-time, and it just gives more credibility to women's football in that, you know, the club are taking this really seriously. We'll have targets to meet, and our aim will be to win promotion to Tier 3 as it was last season, but having that powerful support behind us will make us, you know, a force to be reckoned with.
And I know you were part of the foundation from 2017, I think it was beforehand, but does it feel, I mean, in terms of that symbolism, mm-hmm. actually being owned by the club and being part of the club, that's an important statement moving forward, isn't it? And without, you know, mm-hmm. wishing to sort of delve into the past too much, was there a feeling that you were a bit of an afterthought before?
I think, you know, we've always been proud when the girls pull on the black and white shirt, or when we're, you know, preparing and getting ready and pulling on the Newcastle United tracksuit. It's always been something which we've really been proud of, and we don't want to devalue the support we've had previously, because there's a lot of people worked extremely hard behind the scenes with limited resources to get us to where we are now. But yeah, there's a definite much more professional feel about it. There's more emotional support. There's more care about women's football. And I think there's just more respect with regards to equality for women. The main aim for us has always been equal access. We understand that women's football doesn't offer the same product as men's football currently, but that equal access, you know, as the first focus over kind of anything like equal pay is just really important to us.
And obviously, huge congratulations. You mentioned your promotion, if that's the right word. How will your life change because of that? I mean, in terms of your day-to-day life?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is just being able to focus my full attention on Newcastle United Women, as many coaches in the past have already done. You know, having to balance a full-time job as well as coaching the women's team is, you know, was very challenging. I was full-time working at Northumbria University, running their women's football programme. So having to balance all of that stuff, I mean, there was moments last season where me and the students at Northumbria, some of which are players at Newcastle, travelled all the way down to the University of Bath for a fixture on a Saturday, and then travelled 8 hours back and had Leeds United away on the Sunday. So as you can imagine, challenges like that weekend were very tough, and that probably shows to everybody, you know, how challenging last season was and how well we did to even finish second with the amount of things we had to balance. But we just want to go that one step next season, and that time and resource will really allow me to focus my attention on the team.
And with great responsibility, I'm going to reverse that statement, with great responsibility comes pressure, I should imagine. I mean, it's fantastic that there's been the support for the women's team, but you're under pressure, aren't you, right from the start? I mean, it's a nice pressure, surely, but it's big ambitions.
It is, and I think a lot of people have asked me that question with regards to pressure. And I think, well, me for definite, I put so much pressure on myself over the last couple of seasons to succeed anyway. So no one will put more pressure on me than me. However, I think almost flip it the other way around. I think there's pressure on us to perform, but I would feel very under pressure if I was playing against us, because we'll be a really powerful force in our league this season.
You've made lots of signings, haven't you, this summer? Can you talk us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we have. We've recruited some young players who are in the England under-18 setup, which is brilliant. They're obviously at the young stage of development, but they're obviously brilliant technical players who've got an exciting future here. We've also recruited some experienced players in our kind of tier 3 and tier 2 to play at Newcastle. I think Ellie Dobson obviously made her mark on Sunday with two goals coming off the bench and impacting the team. And we've recruited a couple of players from Durham University who are scholars there. So they've got that excellent education behind them, but also they've got a full-time football model which allows them to, you know, really perform at Newcastle as well.
And does this feel like a transformative era for women's football? I mean, you saw what happens in the summer. I mean, amazing, absolutely sort of amazing scenes. I'm someone who grew up as an England fan, watched England all my life, and finally I've seen an England team, you know, win something. I mean, does it feel like a special period for the women's game?
Definitely. I mean, as a fan, as we all were watching those England Lionesses play, the atmosphere was absolutely electric. I went to the game at Old Trafford and the one at Bramall Lane, and the atmosphere was absolutely outstanding. And one thing that stood out to me when I was walking into Old Trafford, the fan base outside was amazing. And I turned to a friend and I was like, I can't believe the excitement around women's football. And kind of she said to me, yeah, but that was what it was like at your game. But obviously I didn't feel like, so I wasn't the fan outside. So yeah, it's very emotional feel about it. And you could see that from the passion the Lionesses showed at that full-time whistle when they won the Euros. But because the likes of myself and others and, you know, trailblazers who've paved the way for women's football, they've had to do the hard work when they were, you know, the full-time employees just giving up their Sunday, their weekend to play women's football and train after a long 12-hour shift. I think one thing that is worth mentioning with regards to that, though, is that's not the reality anymore for Women's Super League players. But for a lot of championship clubs and a lot of clubs in Tier 3, 4 and below, the reality is that we had a player, for example, who works full-time in the police and comes and plays for our women's team part-time. So the reality is still that there's a lot of work still to be done.
Yeah.
But the way it's going and how positive Newcastle United Football Club have been to support our women's team, with context, we are in Tier 4. But, you know, they're willing to do anything to get the club to the success that we want.
And I know from your Twitter and everything that Dan Ashworth's already been to see training. Have you had a chat with him yet? Because obviously the women's team kind of falls under his remit now as well, which is really encouraging. It's not just the men's team, it's the whole club.
Yeah, I've met a few times with Dan, had a couple of meetings with him. And he's, you know, really ambitious for our women's team as well. And it was great that he popped down to see the players at a training session as well. So the players have met him as well. But yeah, he's really passionate about helping the women's team get to where we want to be as well.
And another part of the announcement was that games will be two games played at St James's this season, and Kingston Park, you'll be there kind of quite regularly, I think.
Yep.
How much of a difference does that make?
Yeah, it's a huge boost. I think having that home crowd advantage is definitely a massive boost, but it's more than just winning the football games. It's about inspiring the whole of the North East and beyond to come and support women's football. And a lot of teams in the Women's Super League are only averaging probably 2,000, 3,000 fans a game. To show we could get 24,000 nearly in Tier 4, I think shows that there is interest there and that people do want to come and watch women's football. But we've obviously got to do our role and make sure that the product is exciting and entertaining and people want to come and watch it.
And then just, you know, for people who maybe didn't come to see that game last season, what can they expect? What can people expect coming to see Newcastle United women's team?
I think they can expect a hard-working group. They're a young group, so they've got tons of energy. We play very energetically and we want to attack as quickly as possible without giving too much away. But we're a team that, you know, we fight hard for clean sheets and we're going to make sure that we're defensively really hard to break down. Our clean sheet record last season, we had 9 clean sheets in the league and we were looking to, as a target, to hit 12 this season. So, yeah, we're going to be a hard team to play against.
So great to hear from Becky Langley there. And obviously this game was at Kingston Park. Newcastle Women's played there in January as well for an Epic Cup tie before that first appearance at St James's Park in May with the huge crowd. What was the atmosphere like for this game, George? What was the sort of attendance? Because the problem they had, unfortunately for them, was that the Newcastle's men's game was moved for TV at exactly the same time. But it was still a pretty good crowd, wasn't it, for fans who turned up?
Yeah, there was more than 1,500 people there, as you say, playing at the same time as the men's team isn't ideal. And, you know, Becky was certainly sort of sad about that. I think they've you know, both their games so far, they've been playing on the same day. So, but they won 2-0. They beat Stockport County, and it's two games in, two victories, which is really impressive. Becky wasn't happy with the way the team played in the first half, which was sort of quite interesting because I thought they played very well, apart from the final ball, perhaps, or the last decision. Certainly, you know, certainly their play wasn't reflected in the scoreline, but a really good goal from Lauren Robson and then a second from Georgia Gibson. And yeah, it was just a lovely, it was a kind of really nice atmosphere. It was great to see them playing firstly in that stadium, you know, a big proper stadium, and very family orientated atmosphere, cheap to get in, lots of families, lots of kids there, lots of black and white, and very encouraging to see the women get that level of support. You know, it's a time of huge change. I mean, it's, you know, for Becky to be made full time, that's obviously a big thing. But the ambition there is that Newcastle will be competing in the Champions League by 2027. So same as with the men's team, it's a very, very ferocious level of ambition there. And the first thing they've got to do is get out of the fourth tier and get promoted. So it's a very good start so far. There is definitely a buzz around the women's team, and I would recommend to all our listeners, if they have a weekend off and the women are playing at home, to go and see them, because it was a great atmosphere and they played really good attacking football, I thought.
And obviously they've made a few signings this summer as well, haven't they? They've really strengthened that team.
Yeah, they've made some signings over the summer. It's a young team. They're looking to kind of get forward as much as possible. And yeah, I mean, that investment is a real thing. I mean, I sort of asked Becky, you know, sort of logistically, how things have changed since coming under the club's umbrella. And it will, you know, it means that they'll get support, much more support from the club. To remind people, they were part of the foundation before, but you know, it means they can draw upon the club's resources. She's already spoken to Dan Ashworth. Dan Ashworth's coming to watch them train, and you know, simple things like having more physio access, but it's also logistics. She was saying even last season they had trouble sometimes organising training, getting places to train. That's all taken care of, and moving forward, eventually they'll be part of the new training ground, training at the same place as Newcastle's men's team and the academy, and absolutely the way it should be. It's about that sort of equality of opportunity, encouraging women and girls to play and providing them with the support to do it. But, you know, I asked Becky about sort of being under pressure, and I like the way that she turned it around and talked about, you know, she thinks that it's going to be the opposition team that's under pressure because Newcastle are going to be good. And, you know, that's a nice attitude to have. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Certainly won't be the last game I go and see there. And yeah, very, very exciting times. Okay, Chris, so I'm going to do this joke in honour of Taylor, who is absent this week, but just to show that he's never forgotten, he's always part of our thoughts. So Jurgen Klopp was asked if he could remember how many Liverpool scored against Bournemouth, and his answer was 9. So we'll never know, will we, Chris?
Oh, God.
We'll never know.
It does feel like the spirit of Taylor's risen from his sickbed and just implanted itself onto you there. It really does.
They're pretty good though, aren't they, Liverpool? I mean, they certainly had a bit of a slow start this season, but that was a pretty decent response to it, wasn't it, Chris?
It was, and the frightening thing was it could and probably should have been more. I mean, Salah could have had a hat-trick and didn't score. Salah, that's almost what was more staggering than the 9-0 result, is that that Salah did not score any of those 9 goals. It is frightening. It's not the ideal sort of preparation going there that they suddenly have managed to get out of the system. But in some ways, you think, well, at least they've gone and thrashed someone else, and hopefully that's them now. Sort of they don't feel that same quite the same frustration in some ways. I suppose the concern for Newcastle is physically how much they've put in the last few matches. Eddie Howe spoke about that after the Wolves game. He said the players are giving everything. They've exerted themselves, and that has physically affected them in terms of the players who who have been unavailable. Kieran Trippier even looked like he pulled up possibly with a little bit of a hamstring injury at Wolves. How said after the game, he didn't know about that, and so obviously Trippier was able to continue. But if you don't have Bruno Guimaraes, who How said won't be there on Wednesday, Callum Wilson isn't going to be available. Still no John Joe Shelvey. Obviously that's a good few months from now. There were other niggles throughout the match. Isak hopefully will be available. They're hoping that the work permit will come through in time. How speculated that maybe because it was a bank holiday, that was part of the reason why it hadn't come through previously. But that's one of the effects of that you've got from Brexit and post-Brexit. This is one of the issues that Newcastle and other Premier League clubs have, is that to sign players from Europe quickly, it can take a little bit longer now to get the sort of work permit sorted. But Isak hopefully will give them a bit more of a boost. Is he likely to start at Anfield? I think that that's probably asking a little bit too much. It would be very un-Eddie Howe-like for him to throw a new signing in, particularly in an away game, even though they are a bit short up front. I do think it'll be slightly different amalgamating Isak into the team to how he did with Bruno, and in theory what they were going to do with Botman before injuries took hold, because I think that it's an attack, with it being an attacking position, it's slightly different to what is required in midfield and in defence in the Premier League. And so I think that Isak, because he's going to bring that extra dimension, will come into the team a little bit quicker, but hopefully he gets a bit of an introduction off the bench on Wednesday, and Newcastle are still in the match by then, because the physically, that's where I'm a little bit worried, just what they've done over the course of the last 10 days. We know what they're capable of if they are physically ready, but if they're a little bit drained, then Liverpool could well take hold, particularly at Anfield, where Newcastle's record is appalling.
It is our intention, Chris, to record a second pod this week, I think, to reflect on the closure of the transfer window, to see how Newcastle have done. We will talk a little bit more about Isak then. Hopefully after seeing him play and score a hat-trick at Anfield. But there is that sense, isn't it? I mean, I know I talked about them scoring 9 goals and things, but it's a fixture to be anticipated now, surely. I mean, yes, I would be happier if Newcastle's main players were fit and firing, but at the same time, we don't go anywhere now, do we? Having that sense of fear that we would have done 12 months ago a little bit more, it's an opportunity to be relished. And even if Newcastle don't win or don't get a positive result, it's not something to be scared of anymore, is it?
No, I don't think it is. I think that it's unfortunate where the Liverpool game is going to fit into the calendar because of the previous games they've had. But equally, Howe does not go into any match thinking that Newcastle are not going to at least try and impose themselves to a degree on the game. That doesn't mean Newcastle are going to dominate the ball in Anfield, because they almost certainly won't. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to have 20-odd chances as they did at Wolves, but what they will do is try and maximise the opportunities they do have. They will commit bodies forward. They will probably press high, I would imagine, as well at certain opportunities, and try and impose themselves onto Liverpool. And that is that's a different shift in mentality from the previous Newcastle United that we knew. Again, it's about what I said, reflect on the Wolves game. Newcastle have come a heck of a long way, and they still have a way to go, but they are in that process, and we know the process is continuing, and they're going to keep improving. And it's just fascinating to see how they actually do at Anfield, given all the caveats which I mentioned previously.
And a couple of weeks ago, when you were off, I wrote a piece basically trying to sort of explain where the club stood in the transfer window. At that point, spoke to someone at the top of the club. They were talking about hopefully making 2 permanent signings. We have got a couple of days left until the window closes. Do you think that's still a realistic possibility? I mean, you know, we do know that the City game changed things in terms of Wilson, in terms of money being freed up. Where do you think things stand? Is it the loan market now? Any up-to-date information?
I think it probably is likely to be the loan market, although Eddie Howe is pushing for more. He was interested on Friday that he was very clear. He kept on being asked in his pretty much press conference about further transfers. I asked him specifically about a midfielder, and he was very clear that he was saying, I would like, ideally, further transfers, but it's not just my decision. I have to wait and see what the club have financially. They've gone above and beyond what he previously expected to manage to get Isak in. As I said earlier, they thought he wasn't achievable for the right price that they could afford early in the window. He has arrived. But really, the priority now is midfield. Ideally, I think Howe would like another wide forward as well, someone who's versatile and can play across the front line. But midfield, the lack of depth that they have now, with Shelvey still being out injured, and with obviously Bruno Guimaraes, his injury has sort of highlighted that. because you may look at it and think, well, Newcastle have got five midfielders, but Howe plays with three. So if you play with three midfielders and suddenly you've got an injury, then you only have one who can come on. And in the world of sort of five substitutions, they have Elliot Anderson, who came on and did very well. And actually, I think he's probably pushing towards a starting place. He did that well when he came on again and haven't performed well at Tranmere, but they just want a bit more deep line creativity there. Someone who maybe releases Bruno to go back to being in that number eight role. They've looked at a few different players, Edson Álvarez and Ajax they like, but I don't think they're going to be able to afford him permanently this window, so I don't see that one necessarily happening. Conor Gallagher, a different player they see as a sort of number eight, is someone they have registered interest in. At Chelsea, David Ornstein, our colleague, has reported that on Monday morning that neither Gallagher nor Christian Pulisic, the winger who Newcastle have also registered an interest in, looks likely to leave at this stage unless Chelsea are given an offer they simply can't refuse. And as I'm saying, if it's going to be loans, then perhaps that isn't going to, neither of those two are necessarily going to be attainable. But Newcastle are actively looking. They are looking for a midfielder primarily, but also I'd say that I'd expect them to try and push for at least one more. Whether they can get two is at this stage looking a little bit unlikely, but I do think they will try and get one at least, probably on loan.
And Newcastle do still need to do outgoing business as well. The squad's too big, we know that. The kind of the biggest name to be linked away at the moment is Martin Dubravka, who's not been involved in the last couple of games. They had to do something with their keepers, didn't they, Chris? But it's that, you know, there has to be more movement elsewhere too.
There does, and interestingly, Emil Kraft's injury, which is very unfortunate, we all wish him a very speedy recovery. An ACL injury, so he's going to be out for certainly the first half of the season, could be the majority of the campaign. That may mean that he is left out of the Premier League squad. In fact, I think it probably will, which lessens one position they need to move on, but they still have too many senior players. And Martin Dubravka, Manchester United do want him. They seem to be preferring a loan with an option. Newcastle would like a permanent or a loan with an obligation. I think Howe is a little bit frustrated by the whole situation. He keeps saying it's not my decision, and he keeps saying I would prefer not to leave and not to lose any players, which seems a little bit unrealistic given that he has four senior keepers and has too many players, so he really does need to move one of them on. But I think he would prefer if it wasn't Dubravka, really, given the experience that he has. So Dubravka may go, and then one or two others from the first team group may depart as well. Matt Ritchie has been coming on in recent games, but I suppose he's someone who's up there. Federico Fernandez has been linked with Stoke. And then I still expect Matty Longstaff will probably go out on loan because he isn't going to feature for the first team group.
Yeah, very interesting. And as we're recording, it looks like Crystal Palace have made a £27 million bid for Gallagher. So whether that shakes things up there, we will have to wait and see. He did very well there on loan, of course. So we'll have to see how things change there. And just to repeat, our plan is to bring you a little short podcast on Friday once all the business is done, hopefully with Taylor back in the presenting seat, because he's a lot better at it than you or I, Chris. No offence to either. Well, a bit of offence.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably tell his jokes better than you did as well. His terrible jokes.
Yeah, that's fine. But the other thing, just as we wrap up, this is quite an interesting quirk. Newcastle have played in four different kits in their last four matches. Is this what they're going to do this season? Is it just going to be a new kit every single match? Is there a fifth kit? Do they have a kit with Jimmy Nail's face on it? That's what I want to know, because certainly I'd buy that one.
Oh, it'd be a great competition. This one, to design the kit for the next game. Oh, that's what they should do.
Yeah.
Bring it in. But, I mean, Jimmy Nail's face would be quite... That would be quite intimidating for the opposition, I think. Imagine Joe Linton running around with a massive picture of Jimmy Linton.
God, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? That's quite a good idea. Castore, if you're listening, I want 10% of that. And certainly look forward to receiving my shirt in about 4 years' time when you finally can be bothered to dispatch it.
Yeah, I mean, the kits... So there were the bizarre one at Brighton, which was the sort of one-off training kit, which I still thought was laughable, how you can have three kits and yet they still manage to clash with Brighton's kit. So that was puzzling in its own accord. Then they obviously played at home against Man City, wore black and white, wore the dark blue and orange shorts on Wednesday at Tranmere.
Which
you like. I think that the shorts don't quite match the shirt. I think they look like two different kits, but that's just me personally. But the kit I did not like the kit on Sunday. I know that this riles some people, but I don't make any apologies for it. I just don't like it. I just don't think it looks like a Newcastle United kit. Now, that sounds bizarre because no away kit really should look like a Newcastle United kit in many ways, but I don't like it. I don't even think it's a particularly nice kit of its own accord anyway. And so, yeah, that was a little bit, to see it for the first time it did sort of leave a little bit of a sour taste in my mouth, I have to be honest.
I'm not a big fan, but I am a Newcastle fan. So I think we're entitled to give our opinions. And we know from people speaking to people at the club that it was a Castore-oriented decision, that they thought it was the right thing, a good thing to do potentially to use Saudi colours, and it was then signed off by the club. So that is a deliberate policy. And, you know, I want Newcastle United to represent Newcastle. I don't want them to represent anywhere else. So, yeah, not a fan of it either. But anyway, you know, we'll have to see if they wear something else at Anfield.
Yes, and obviously I will be at Anfield to cover that match for The Athletic. And in the meantime, just to remind you once again about our subscription offer. You can subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 per month for the first 6 months and get access to all our great writing as well as ad-free versions of The Athletic's podcasts at theathletic.com/NewcastlePod. That's theathletic.com/NewcastlePod.
All right, well, it's time to call it a day. So, Chris, you're off for your second away match in the space of a few days. Sorry about that. I'm quite surprised as well that you're deigning to do that. But it's funny, yeah.
You're just being very lazy, aren't you? So.
Yeah, you're happy to do the glamour ones, aren't you?
The glamour ones, yeah. The glamour of Wolverhampton. Yeah, that was...
Okay, whatever. Right, well, hopefully Taylor will be back later on this week. But fingers crossed for another positive result. And we will see you, all things being equal, later on this week. Cheers for listening.
Toodaloo.
You mentioned the Ryan Fraser. Do that again. You mentioned that Ryan Fraser incident where he was pulled back by. Nope. What possession did Newcastle have in that game yesterday, Chris?
They had 2 seconds. Let me check this. Sorry, I think it's 62.
60 something.
Newcastle had 64% possession.
And the wisdom of signing Isak. Shearer approves, but do we need more involvement? Two really good goals in the damn it.
Just to remind you once again about our subscription offer, you can subscribe to The Athletic. What is the actual offer?
That was just awful, wasn't it? Thank you very much for listening, and yeah, keep your what did I say there?
Yeah, I don't know what you'd said. I don't know. You sort of just.
It's not easy, this, is it? Get well soon, Taylor.
The Athletic.